Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Newberry of Madison, a National Shelter Medicine Extension veterinarian with the Corret Shelter Medicine Program at the Center for Companion Animal Health at the University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She continues to be the medical director of the Dane County Humane Society as well, and we're really pleased to have her back to talk with you about your pet's health. And if you want to join in, you're most welcome. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Dr. Sandy Newberry, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you back. And, you know, as I was promoting the program, I was talking about the more than 100,000 calls that came from the Animal Poison Control Center. Several pertain to common household items. And you come in this morning to tell me that you've had a bad experience relating to your own pets.
Yeah, and so knowing that that was going to be one of the things we were going to talk about this morning, we were going to talk about sort of common household toxins, I was upstairs in my office, and I was on the ASPCA Poison Control website, which is one that I would recommend to everybody to spend some time on, because there may be things on there that you might not think of as common household toxins. And one of the things I was reading about this morning that's interesting, because I really didn't know about it at all, is a sweetener called xylitol that's found in sugar-free gum and other unsweetened, you know, or sweetened, artificially sweetened products. And as I was reading through the section that the ASPCA had on their website about xylitol, I was thinking that my son had just the other day, when we were at the grocery store, wanted to get some gum and had picked out gum that said xylitol on it. And I thought to myself, I wonder if it's okay for kids to have gum with xylitol, but decided I'd let him have it. And when I came downstairs after doing the research I was doing up on my computer, my new little puppy had gotten the pack of gum that we had just bought at the grocery store and had ingested really the entire pack of gum minus the two sticks that had been missing when we left the grocery store. And so the reason that I'm late this morning is I've just come from the vet school where I dropped off my puppy, because xylitol has an idiosyncratic effect that can affect dogs' livers and can cause them to go into liver failure. It can also, the thing that is also really something important for people to think about, it can cause hypoglycemia. And so a dog may wind up not having enough blood glucose in their blood. And so they really need to go to a veterinarian and see a veterinarian and have their glucose monitored and get on fluids right away to help support their liver. And it's not necessarily a dose-dependent kind of problem. So she's a really small dog. She's only about 10 pounds. And she, you know, ate a good amount of gum. So she got a fairly small dose still because of how much is in the gum. But we know that, you know, when we looked up studies and we talked to some people at the CDC, that it can be even a very small amount may affect even a big dog, or some dogs may not be affected at all. And this is a kind of a common way that these kind of toxins work. And so the importance of being on the website, and, you know, from 2020 hindsight, I can say that while you're on the website, be sure you know where your puppy is. But to go to that website and spend some time and look up the things that are there. They have lists of plants that are toxic that may be things that you haven't thought of, lists of common things that you find around the house that may be toxic. And, you know, I can tell you right now, you know, from personal experience, these things are very real and need to be taken seriously, because even though your dog may be the dog that's unaffected, it may not be. And so the best thing to do is intervene early. And my dog's lucky. I had things around the house and could make her throw up right away. And funny for a dog to think of themselves as being lucky for that. But these are things to think about and make sure you're prepared for these kinds of things at home, because if I had waited until I had time to get her to the vet school and had her throw up then, her prognosis may be poorer.
Well, let's hope the prognosis is good and that the folks at the vet school do a wonderful job. So
they certainly do.
And you'll be running right to the vet school probably right after this program.
Right, we'll be going right back over there.
Well, I tell you what, we have so many people who want to visit with you and Sandy, and so let's go to the phones. And Sabina in Rhinelander, you are up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
I have, Good morning. I have two golden retrievers, a seven-year-old and his year-and-a-half-old son. Both of them were having some weight problems. The father is not neutered, the son is, which apparently is important in this particular issue. Anyway, I had them both on the same diet. The father lost 9 pounds, the son gained 2. I had him checked for thyroid problems, which was the father's issue, and that was not an issue. Does having them neutered have such a monumental effect on their weight, and what can I do to make it better?
Okay, so just to clarify, I'm assuming the problem is that he's overweight, your younger dog.
Yes, correct.
I would be a little concerned in both directions here. So if the younger dog is gaining weight and the older dog is losing weight, as long as the older dog is losing weight at the rate that you're hoping that he would have lost weight, that's great. But what I'd want to be sure of is that the older dog isn't losing weight for some other reason. So I know that's not the question that you called to ask,
okay,
but
well,
that would be kind of one of the first things that would come to my mind. He is an older dog, and, you know, why is he losing weight at such a rapid rate? Or if it is a rapid rate, you didn't give a sense of how long you had them on the special food. But so that's something, first of all, just to kind of tuck in the back of your mind.
Well, let me ask you quick. It was a 2-month period. The son gained 2, the father lost 9. Is that too much in a 2-month period?
I mean, that's okay for a dog as long as that was kind of what you were targeting. So as long as that was kind of your plan and the dog seems healthy and happy and is exercising and all of that. The most important thing when you're trying to diet dogs is really to, and often I really, really will recommend for people to work with a veterinarian when you're trying to diet your dog and trying to do a weight loss program, because there's lots of different foods out there that are helpful for that. But the thing that you really need to look at is caloric intake and then exercise level and what the actual maintenance needs of the dog are. And so what it may be is, you know, that each dog needs a different amount of food, even though they're both golden retrievers, you know, that they may both need a different amount of food, and the amount of each particular food is going to vary. So there's some foods where your dogs may need a cup, and there's other foods where your dog may need 2 cups, because it depends on the sort of caloric content and the energy content of the food.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things a veterinarian can help you with. But in terms of the dog being neutered or unneutered, I'll sort of couch this all in something that many people know about me, is that I strongly advocate for neutering in dogs. But also I can tell you that most of the research out there doesn't show that there's going to be a huge impact. It's not really true that dogs that get spayed or neutered, you know, instantly have to become, you know, big fat couch potatoes. And so just because a dog is neutered doesn't mean it's going to gain weight. It has to do with their exercise program and their caloric intake.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
Good luck with it.
Brad in Green Bay, it's your turn next. Hi, Brad. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Yeah, I have 2 cats. One's a male, about a year old, and I have a female cat that's about 2.5 years old.
Okay.
And weight-wise, one's about 9, the male's about 9, and the female's about 10 pounds,
mm-hmm.
11 pounds. But I'm having a problem with the male cat. He has a problem holding food down.
Uh-huh.
I'm going by what the package says for feeding and, you know, for measurement-wise. And but I don't know, say after maybe like 4 hours, something like that, 5 hours of feeding, he keeps on getting sick.
So he's throwing up?
Mm-hmm.
And when he's throwing up, does it look just like the food that went down?
Yeah.
Okay. So I would start out again with a trip to the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that I would kind of start out with, if he seems otherwise really pretty healthy, I would start out with thinking about, you know, might he have worms? Some cats will also, they'll just kind of eat too fast, and then when it fills up their stomach, then they throw up later. There's really a lot of reasons, from really, really mild and not such a big deal to much more important things that need to kind of get ruled out when a cat's throwing up. And what you're talking about, it sounds probably, you know, again, this is great talk for the radio, but what needs to get differentiating is the cat regurgitating the food. So is it really never getting all the way into the stomach and settling and starting to get digested, or is he really vomiting the food? And those are two different things. And depending on what you're describing, it kind of sounds like he's regurgitating the food. And so you look at different causes for that. But there's certain things that we can, you know, simple things that you might want to just start out with and rule out, like worms or things like that. And then after that, you know, try to figure out if maybe a different food might help him. Eating a little bit slower in smaller quantities might help.
That's one thing. He's a real fast eater.
So he's a real fast eater, and that's probably regurgitation. And so what will happen sometimes is the cat will just eat this enormous quantity that fills their stomach about as full as it could possibly be.
Uh-huh.
They sit around kind of uncomfortable for a while, and then they'll throw it back up again. And so it may be that what you need to try to do is to feed him in smaller quantities.
Well, that's what I have. I broke it down like in fourths throughout the day.
And does that help?
No.
So if that's not helping, then I would definitely get him in to see the vet and just have them kind of do some basic checks on him and see what's going on, why he's not keeping the food done. It sounds like it's really a time for a trip to the vet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he just was in for his shots.
Uh-huh.
But there was nothing that turned up. I asked him, and the vet, I didn't really get an answer from him.
Hmm. I would try to push the vet a little bit more than maybe. And then also the other things you could try is try some different kinds of food and see if the same thing is happening. So maybe try a canned food instead of a dry food if you're feeding a dry food now.
Dry food.
And just to see if anything helps so that you can kind of figure out, well, you know, hey, every time I feed him canned food, it doesn't happen. And so then figure out if there's something different. I mean, he's a young cat, so odds are it's not something really, really serious, but it may be. And so it's the kind of thing that you want to look into just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Brad, for calling. And Sandy in Milwaukee, it's your turn next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I adopted a dachshund from Humane Society. It was in December. And the next week he was neutered the day before I got him. And he didn't have a colon, so he ended up with an infection after I took him home. So I took him to the vet, and they put him on antibiotics. Then it was starting to heal up, but then I noticed he had a really bad odor with a little discharge. And so then I took him back to the vet, and they did a urinalysis, and they said that he had crystals in his urine. And then he went on antibiotics again, and they weren't sure if the crystals was something that the dog was going to produce all his life or if it was from the infection. So then he started urinating all over the house. It was like he just couldn't hold it. But they put him on this special dog food for crystals, canned mm-hmm. dog food by Science Diet.
Mm-hmm.
And when he started on that, he really started urinating. You just mentioned the word going outside, and he'd start. And mm-hmm. he'd look at himself like he couldn't believe it was coming out. He didn't even know he had a goal. Then I started carrying him down the steps. I got three flights. And that worked for about a day or so. And then when I would reach down to pick him up, to take him out, to carry him down the steps, he would just start going.
Okay.
So I went back to the vet, and they put him on antibiotics again, thinking it might be an infection, and now they're testing the urine, but I haven't gotten the results.
Okay. So the first thing is, when a dog gets neutered, there's usually an incision that's called the prescrotal incision, and so they make that incision that's basically just in front of the scrotum where the testicles are. And it sounds like, is that what you're talking about, where the first, what you thought was a sign of infection was at the incision?
That was the first. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then the next thing that you're describing where you thought you smelled a bad odor, was that from the incision or was that from his penis where he was
from
going to
penis.
The bathroom? Okay. So those are probably different issues. would be my guess. May not be, but probably different issues. When dogs get crystals, it's not quite the same as in cats. Cats are much more prone to sort of just developing crystal precipitation in their urine than dogs are. And so when dogs develop crystals, depending on the type of crystal, and again, since I'm getting the information from you, I can't know what kind of crystals your veterinarian was seeing. But depending on the type of crystals, the most common type of crystals that's found in dog's urine is usually related to bacterial infection. And so usually what's done is that they try to treat the bacterial infection. Usually you try to check and see if you can see the bacteria there, and you try to treat the bacterial infection, and the bacterial infection often will make the crystals go away because it's something about the bacteria that change the pH in the urine that allows the crystals to form in the first place.
Okay.
But the other thing that can happen is that crystals can form from other things like metabolic disease, mostly from other kinds of metabolic diseases. And so it's really important in dogs as well as in cats, but especially in a case like this, to know what kind of crystals were being seen in the urine, because that may indicate a need for further testing. Now, the other thing that you're describing about your dog kind of just peeing all over the place, is the dog drinking a lot of water too?
No, that's the thing. He doesn't drink as much water as he goes.
Yeah. So what it sounds like is that for some reason, you know, he's urinating more than what he can kind of keep up with and going out. And usually what we see when dogs are urinating large amounts like that, it tends to be that then they drink enough to kind of keep up with it. But so it may be that you want to take him back to the vet and have them look at some blood work and make sure that there's not anything going on wrong with his kidneys or any of his other sort of systems. Is he an older dog or a younger dog?
Oh, no, he's 1 year old now.
Okay, but you may want to just have that checked out to see if there's anything that's making him pee quite so much. And it may be some dogs, when they have urinary tract infections, that'll make them pee more. There's other infections that they can get also that can cause them to need to pee more or cause, you know, problems with their kidneys. And so that's something that I would definitely look into with what you're describing about the dog wanting to kind of just and needing to just urinate all over the place. So the first thing is to kind of find out what kind of crystals and whether those kind of crystals really indicate an infection or something else. And then some other kind of metabolic disease. And then also just to do some screening blood work and see, make sure that everything else is okay with the dog first. Mm-hmm.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Sandy, for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Newberry, our guest today, who is the medical director of the Dane County Humane Society and also National Shelter Medicine Extension Veterinarian with the Corret Shelter Medicine Program. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Newberry. Thanks for listening in. If you have a question for her, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. You don't treat colds in humans by any chance, do we ever?
No, but it sounds like maybe you might need a trip to the veterinarian, too.
Oh, boy. Lori in Reedstown, it's your turn. Hi, Lori. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
My question is on two different cats.
Okay.
And one I had in the house, and when I had to move, he had to go to a friend's house. Well, he's been outside for a couple of years, learned how to hunt. Learned how to take care of himself, and I brought him home yesterday. Now, my problem is that I also have another cat here now because I figured it'd be nice for him to have a friend, and she's a female, declawed. They're both fixed, but she now feels like this is her house and I'm her mommy, and he knows that it's now his house and I'm his mommy, and all they do is hiss at each other.
So the thing that we usually recommend when you're trying to bring two cats together, cats are very territorial creatures, and you're part of the territory too. You count. And so what we usually recommend for cats is a slow introduction. Cats are not fond of new things, really. Dogs really like novelty in their lives. Dogs like novelty in their food. They like novelty, you know, everywhere. Everything about dogs enjoys novelty. Cats do not like novelty. They like routines. And so the best thing to do when you're trying to introduce two cats to each other is to minimize the novelty as much as you possibly can. And so what we usually recommend is whoever was in the house first, that, you know, which sounds like it was this female cat at this point, let her have her territory, but give your other cat one room of the house. And if you can, you know, it sounds like you've already done this. So now what you're going to do is going to have to be what we call isolate and reintroduce. And so, you know, what you want to do is put the one cat in one room, give him everything he needs in there, his litter box, his food and his water and all that stuff. And then after a few days, if your female settles down, like she's going to spend a lot of time at the door, a lot of time hissing and, you know, trying to figure out what's on the other side, even though she knows at this point. Then you take something that has been in his room, something maybe that he's been sitting on, like a blanket or a shirt or something like that, and put that out in her territory so she can get used to the way that he smells. And then when she doesn't care so much about that thing that you put in, that's probably the time where you can start to really introduce the two cats, because she can get all the information that she needs about him from that thing that you took from his territory and put it into hers. And you can do the same thing for him, too, though, you know, her smell is already going to be in the territory. But if you've got something that smells like her, you know, then you can swap them like that. And hissing, again, hissing in cats is, you know, that's normal communication for cats. And so, you know, hissing is okay when you're introducing cats. Of course, you don't want it to go on forever, but you need to let them figure that out, and they need to sort of establish that whole scene. So hissing's okay, posturing's okay. We really don't want them fighting and, you know, hurting each other, but hissing is just a way of, you know, it's one of the things I respect most about cats, that I think, you know, they're very clear in their communications in that way.
You know, when we brought home a cat from the Dane County Humane Society, we already had a kitty, we kept a Hunter, was the new cat, way out in another room for several months.
Yeah, and you know, we joke all the time that when it comes to putting cats together, it's really the humans who are impatient about that. The humans really want the cats to be together, but cats really take their time about figuring out whether they want to be together or not. And so this slow introduction process is usually the best process for getting cats to be fast friends in the end.
What do you think about the, in addition to what you've said, the pheromone, the feel-away type?
Yeah, that's another, you know, the feel-away pheromones, it's kind of a happy cat smell for cats, and that's also, I think, something that's really great and something that you can use in your home all the time or even just during times of introduction, and they even make those as little plugins that you can, you know, plug into outlets, and that it'll just kind of release those pheromones over time. That's a great idea.
It seems to help, and not always, but many times it does help. And the beauty of it, you plug it into the wall.
Yeah, and it's actually
it's really
a facial pheromone. And so when you see cats that come up to you and kind of rub their cheeks on you, or you see them rub their cheeks on you know, the furniture or the doorpost or something like that, that's that same pheromone, and that's, you know, that's kind of a happy thing for cats. And so it's, you know, hopefully that may help too. And there's lots of reports that it really does help with stress in cats.
With an open layout here, I would have trouble blocking one into a room.
Even if it's a bathroom, it's really worth, you know, doing.
Okay, because right now she's staying in the back bedroom, and she doesn't want to come out.
Yeah, well, but you can, so then you can either let her make that choice, and you can isolate her and let him have run of the house. And then over time, you know, let that door be open, or you can, you know, you have to just pick a room and put one cat in the room and one cat not in the room.
We had the door closed, but then after a while, we opened the door, but we used one of these
baby gate across.
Yeah. And that went on for I forget how long, but
yeah, it really does. You know, it helps to build strong relationships in cats, this slower introduction process, and it's humans who are the impatient ones.
Good luck, Lori. Thank you very much. Al in Appleton, it is your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Trying to make this rather long story short. I have a 9-year-old black lab, 9.5-year-old black lab, that in around the third week of January, it got this growth in her nose, in her right nostril, and growth on her back foot, and an infection in her eye. Had the biopsy taken, thought it was cancer, turns out it wasn't, thought it was, and the vet assumed it was an infection, put her on an antibiotic, didn't touch it at all. It continued to get worse, couldn't breathe. Anyhow, took her back, ran another test for a disease, a fungal disease called, I believe, blastomycosis.
Mm-hmm. Blastomycosis, yeah. I had that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Not fun.
Yeah.
You're right. That's what I heard. And usually, apparently, it goes into their lungs, but she didn't have any respiratory problems, but it seemed to be coming out, and the vet said it can do this, come out in sores, like in this growth in her nostril and then on her back hip also.
Right.
And it actually smelled, and we almost, believe it or not, 2.5 weeks ago, we almost put her to sleep because she was in such distress.
Right.
The vet decided, gave another test. The test never did come back positive for blasto. He thinks that's what it is. He said he's 80-90% sure because the antibiotics didn't seem to touch this. So he put her and gave her a shot of a very powerful steroid to try to reduce the inflammation. He said it also would suppress her immune system. So it was kind of a touchy thing as to whether it might actually make her worse. But anyhow, it's a miracle cure so far. She's doing really well. The tumor in her nose shrank. The thing on her hip shrank. Her eye infection cleared up. And he put her on, it was called
Itraconazole.
Itraconazole, which is,
great.
You're probably aware, it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I almost flipped out because, like, 5 days of tablets was $65.
Right.
And he said she'd have to be on this for several months. Is that correct?
Yeah. The other thing, you can talk to your veterinarian about a drug called fluconazole as well. Fluconazole is a similar drug to itraconazole, and it's recently gone generic. And so often fluconazole can be obtained a little bit less expensively than the itraconazole. The problem is, you know, in a big dog, when you add up the cost of antifungals, without the antifungals, though, blastomycosis is a really, really horrible disease. Mm-hmm. And so without, you know, she really needs to have that antifungal treatment. And so that's another option you can consider. But I'm so sorry. I hope she'll do better. It's great to hear that she is doing better.
Does she need to be on this itraconazole for several months at least?
Most likely.
Okay. One more question. I don't want to take up any more time. My wife actually works for a physician who has a dog that had this same disease, and over the internet got some itraconazole from, it says, Unison Labs. And I'm always suspicious about stuff that comes over the internet because you hear drugs. It's manufactured by Unison Labs in Thailand, which makes me a little, I don't know, nervous about giving.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about buying drugs like from Unison Labs from Thailand?
I don't know about that particular lab. I can tell you that when we use a lot of itraconazole because I've done a lot of work with fungal diseases in cats, and one of the things that we have found, and most veterinarians will be willing to do this, is if you have your vet write you a prescription, you can look on the internet and see if you can find, you know, a cheaper source for the drug and order from the internet. But when we do that, we try to make sure and tell people that what we want you to do is, you know, not buy off-label products. So you want to buy the label product. And so for itraconazole, that usually means Sporanox is what you want to be buying if you're looking. And so we recommend people not buy compounded products and things like that. But you can look from other countries. You know, I know that those are places, or even on the internet from internet pharmacies, you can often get a better price. I would also just try to talk with your vet about fluconazole, because I think you may find that fluconazole is cheaper than itraconazole, even if you're trying to buy it over the internet.
No.
Fluconazole?
Flu, F-L-U.
Okay.
All right.
And like I said, I'm more concerned about this internet drug from Thailand. I just am concerned because I have it free. She gave it to us free and enough for several months.
Yeah. And again, if your veterinarian is comfortable and she knows the source, but what we usually recommend when using itraconazole is to make sure you're using the product that, you know, that we know that's not a compounded product.
Yeah, you should, and you probably have or probably plan to take that material, or take that medication in to show to your veterinarian and see what your veterinarian says about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck, Al. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ann in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a puppy, a five-month-old lab, and I'm about to start him on heartworm and so forth, and I'm really concerned about the increase in cancer in dogs, and I have friends that will only give their animals what's required by law, and I've heard of holistic vets who won't give them any, say, topical flea repellents, and I just wonder what your thinking was on those, what would be appropriate and what wouldn't be.
Well, if you're talking about, are you talking about heartworm disease, you know?
Well, the heart guard.
Okay. So the thing I think that's the most important thing for people to keep in mind when it comes to heartworm is that, you know, that the products that we're giving in general as heartworm preventative products are very, very safe products. And most of them are made with ivermectin or some form of ivermectin, some or a similar drug. Salamectin is another very similar drug. And it's usually given in very low doses, and there's no reported association with cancer, as far as I know, with those drugs. And I worry sometimes when I hear people talking about, you know, trying to minimize medications and things like that that they're giving to their animals. Heartworm disease is a really, really serious disease.
Well, that's what I feel. I mean, I don't want my dog to go through that at all.
Right. And prevention of heartworm disease, again, has very, very few side effects. Heartworm disease itself is a very serious disease, and the treatment for heartworm disease is really not a benign process at all.
No. But say that the flea repellents, such as Frontline and those, I know people that won't give those at all to their dogs.
And again, I haven't seen any correlation with those drugs and, you know, and cancer or other problems. You know, there's a suspected adverse reaction reporting system that goes on, and I think those drugs have been considered to be very safe drugs given at appropriate doses. And I think, again, one of the important things to think about when you're, you know, it's not unreasonable. Everybody, I think, when we think about chemicals in the world and, you know, to try to kind of minimize how many chemicals we're all exposed to.
Well, I'm concerned about how much testing they do on veterinary men's as opposed to the FDA's testing for people.
Yeah. You know, there's a fair amount of safety testing that has to go into drugs before they're released. And some of those drugs that you're talking about would be labeled by the USDA, and some of them would be labeled by the EPA. So some of them are labeled as insecticides, and some of them are labeled as drugs. And so depending on which one is labeled which way, there may be different testing that goes into it. But those drugs are very widely used without any, you know, real major considerations and concerns for safety. And the thing that, again, you have to think about is that the risk of, you know, tick-borne diseases, flea-borne diseases, and the risks of, you know, fleas and ticks are very real risks. And so it can be really important to consider using those preventatives. On the other hand, you know, if your dog lives in the middle of an urban environment and there's very few fleas or ticks around, then it may be something that you feel like you can use more on an as-needed basis and not have to use it all the time.
He's a black lab, and we have woods around, and the mosquitoes are going to be all over him.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, fleas and ticks, it's a real risk around, you know, for dogs like that. And so the risk, you know, the risk of not treating, I think, probably outweighs the risk of treating.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. Chris in Wilson, Michigan, I believe, is next. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Hey, I'm wondering if you could talk some about the poisonous effect of grapes and raisins for dogs. I kind of stumbled across that a few years ago after having fed my dog more raisins than I want to think about.
Yeah.
And also, do they have the same effect for cats? And are there other just kind of regular people food kind of things that we normally just wouldn't think about as being so
dangerous? A problem? Yeah.
Yeah. And so the main thing I'll do is I'll direct you back to that ASPCA website. You know, we are so lucky to have that website. It really is an amazing site that the ASPCA has put up, and they are constantly doing research. I have a paper in my bag, you know, that a veterinarian, you know, that they just put out on xylitol. And to be really honest, there were many of us who were walking around, and if it had been a week ago and my dog had gotten into a pack of gum and eaten it and it had xylitol, I might not have done anything because I wouldn't have thought that that was even a problem. But because I had been on this website and perusing it and was aware of what the toxins were, you know, then I knew. And there's many cases where you call in even to veterinarians' offices and they're like, wow, xylitol is bad. Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, I better get on there and look. And so it gives you a listing of all the things that are potential toxins, and they're constantly updating it because of the reports that they get in, and they get calls, you know, about things, and so they keep lists of those. Raisins and grapes, where dogs are concerned, it's a renal issue, and it can cause acute renal toxicity, and so it's something that if your dog, you know, it's something that you want to avoid. You want to avoid letting your dog eat raisins and grapes, and if for some reason your dog, you know, gets into the raisins and gets into the grapes, what they need is to get into a veterinarian. They need to, you know, throw up all those raisins and grapes as much as they can. They feed activated charcoal in the hopes that it'll help absorb those things, and they put them on fluids in hope for the best. And usually dogs are okay with that. And so the problems come in with toxins because dogs don't all have the same reactions to it, and no animals do. And one of the things that causes problems, too, is that different animals have different ways of metabolizing different drugs. Drugs are complicated things that are designed usually for a particular species, and they're not going to act the same way in every species. And so the best thing that anybody can do, really, is, and Larry's pulled up the website while we're sitting here, is to go to that website and familiarize yourself with it. They even have a little place I saw this morning where you can go and kind of try to memorize the top 10 toxic plants. Because people aren't necessarily going to think about that, you know, when those things come into the house.
And I just put ASPCA into a search engine and it popped right up. So It's a good place to go.
It's an excellent site. I have been out there before and just got a ton of information that I just didn't know about. Now, just one other question. Do they know yet at this point if there's a similar problem for cats with raisins and grapes, or is it so far looking like it's more
for dogs?
I think the problem is more related to dogs, but I think it is also a theoretical problem with cats. That is a question, just so you know, that I would go back and look up. And just so you know, that's what's going to happen. Most of the time when you call your vet and you say, my dog got into blah, and I saw on the ASPCA website that that's not a good thing to get into, your vet's going to say, you know, bring the dog in. And by the time you get there, which is exactly what happened this morning, even at the veterinary school, by the time I got there, someone had gone online, gone to the resources and printed out everything that, you know, all the information that they needed about, you know, well, how does this particular toxin work? Because no vet can keep in their brain, you know, how you respond to each particular toxin with each particular species. And so then, depending on what they find when they look things up, that's going to influence what, you know, what they do as a treatment. And sometimes they're even going to contact someone who's the expert on that particular toxin in that particular species, and they're going to say, well, this is the treatment that seems to be working the most successfully. And so, you know, that's one of the things to go through.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
I want to add one thing when we go back and we think about the whole question of treating for fleas and ticks, too. The other thing, you know, we're really lucky for this ASPCA website and that there are people who are out there working their butts off, really, for us to know, you know, what toxins there are that are going to cause problems. We're also really, really lucky that we have the flea and tick products that we have right now. And there's a lot of people, I think, who never lived through through, especially never lived through animal shelters, when we didn't have the flea and tick products that we have now. And, you know, having animals come in and seeing the devastation that can happen to animals from a simple flea infestation or from tick infestations is really, you know, it's just something that we don't see very often, especially in the northern climates. And we don't see it as often because we have these products that we can use really easily and really safely with the animals, where the old products were not very safe, caused tons of problems and weren't even very effective.
Wow. Thanks again, Chris, for calling. I appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Newberry, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Newberry. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Corey in Green Bay next. Corey, hi.
Hi. We have a 3.5-year-old cat, and we have an 18-month-old daughter. And a few months, or like about a month ago, our cat uses a cat door to go to the basement where we have two different kitty litter boxes. About a month ago, our daughter locked the cat door. We didn't realize it. When we realized it was when the cat had used our daughter's bed and the couch had urinated and on that. So anyways, we opened up the cat door, showed her back and forth going through, and thought everything would be okay, but we were making sure to bring her downstairs to make sure that the cat would use the litter box. So my husband took her downstairs, and no less than 5 minutes after taking the cat downstairs, the cat came upstairs and then, you know, urinated on the couch again. So we're kind of stuck. We don't exactly know what to do. Currently, we just kind of closed up the cat door, blocked it off so the cat doesn't know, and the cat's locked in the basement right now, which we don't think is the best, but we can't have a cat urinating around the house. Right. We have ruled out medical reasoning. We have tried, like, the feel-away plug-in stuff, and we've tried some stuff that you mix in the kitty litter.
The cat attract.
Yeah. And we're going to have a new baby in a couple weeks. So, you know, yeah, we're just kind of really unsure of what to do now.
Yeah, and just so you know, I mean, this is one of the hardest topics there is when it comes to cats. And I've had a lot of personal experience with this as well. So the first thing to think about is, what did you do to clean up the couch? Because if the couch still smells like...
We use veterinarian recommended stuff. And actually the second, when she came up, you know, right after being downstairs, came upstairs and did it right in front of us, was a completely different area than she had done before.
Okay.
It wasn't on top of the old stuff. So we think that it wasn't the smell.
Okay. So as to the right in front of us, animals don't really understand that they're being naughty. As much as it seems like to us, like they do, they don't in most cases understand. You know, they understand that your reaction was bad, but they don't really, they're not intentionally doing it to drive us insane. But so
we do figure that, but we're just, you know, not sure of what we should do. And like I said, you know, we can't, you know, and clean it up, so I don't know. Yeah, we kept
so it's in a different spot, but it's still on the couch?
It was a different spot, but it was on the couch, but it was 8 feet away from the spot.
Yeah. And so, you know, what happens is surface preferences develop.
The cleaner we used was like the veterinarian recommended one.
Right. So the cleaner that I usually recommend to everybody is called Nature's Miracle.
And we used that stuff.
That's what you used. Okay, great. The problem is, you know, now she's got a pattern and she found a place that she likes to pee, and she likes to pee there better than she likes to pee through the door and down all the way into the basement. Mm-hmm. And so what you need to do is see if, when you're trying to train cats, the kind of thing you have to keep in your mind is, how can I make what I want her to do more attractive to her than what she wants to do? And so, there's all sorts of different kinds of things to try. This is in truth one of the hardest things to get through, and you may want to consult a behaviorist right away if you're able to do that, and get somebody who will come in and really work with you and see if you can, you know, turn it around right away. But the idea is to really try to make it more attractive to go where you want her to go. So the first thing that I heard in what you said that I would want to address is the fact that while it's great, and I wish I could have it, to have the litter boxes down in the basement. It's especially great when you have little kids running around because then they're not playing in the litter boxes too. That it may be that you need a litter box closer to where she is peeing. And then it may be that, you know, she's figured out, wow, I don't have to go down to the basement. I don't really like to go down to the basement. And I'm sure that, you know, you probably can remember sometime when you were watching a movie and it would be much nicer if there was a bathroom right around the corner than if you had to go, you know, either all the way upstairs or downstairs to get to the bathroom. And so she's figured that out. And so it may be that you're going to have to add another litter box for her in more in proximity to where she's actually going. And that may be, at least temporarily, that may get her out of the habit of doing it on the couch. And so I know that's hard. I mean, not very many people want to have a litter box in their living room.
Next to the couch.
But it may be... But it may be that in the short run, that may be something to try and see, well, if I put a litter box in this room, will she at least use the litter box in there? And then over time, kind of move it to a different location if you can at least get her out of the habit of peeing on the couch. You can also do things to make the couch less attractive to her. So
but she did also, you know, like I said, she did pee on the baby's bed.
Right.
So. I mean, do we address both of them?
Yeah, or? So I would address both, though at this point, you know, if she did that one time because she couldn't get down to the litter box and now she's not going back, my concern is, though, that, you know, now she's found that she likes, you know, soft places to pee. And so, mm-hmm. you know, try as much as you can to keep soft things off the floor, to make those kind of soft places inaccessible to her. If she was peeing on the baby's bed, can you keep her out of the baby's room so she's not going to pee on the mm-hmm. baby's bed again? Try introducing a litter box in an area that's, you know, closer to where she wants to pee, and then try seeing if there are things you can do to make the couch less attractive to her. And it may include things like, you know, I know that there'll be sometimes where people will take cans or something so that when she jumps up on the couch, it's going to make a big clattering noise. Or you can take tinfoil and put that over the couch so that when she gets up there, it's not such an attractive surface to her. And these are not long-term kinds of things, but that if you can change her mind about that being an attractive place and try to get her back to using the box.
As a precaution, should we do it on all of the furniture in the living room?
I would.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. And then the other thing that Larry had talked about before is to introduce some of the feline facial pheromone may help, too, because...
We had, like, this pheromone stuff. We had a spray on the couch, and we had a plug-in one.
Yeah, so I would try with the plug-in one. The other thing, you know, it's really hard to know sometimes what gets something started, and I think sometimes we go back and come up with a reason that something started. And it may be because she got locked out of the litter box at some point, but it also may be that it's just really stressful having an 18-month-old baby in the house. And, you know, from my own personal experience, I had a cat that was really stressed by my son. And would pee on his bed and do things like that. And so it may be that there's other things that you can think of if you sit down to think about the things that are stressing her in her life. And if there's other things you can do to try to minimize her stress, often inappropriate elimination in cats has some kind of stress component associated mm-hmm. with it.
And it's probably one of the main reasons that cats are put to sleep.
It's relinquished or put to sleep. It's really, I mean, there is nothing that breaks the human-animal bond faster, I think, than inappropriate elimination, especially in cats, because the smell is so awful. So the other thing that you may want to do, and this is something that I've done at times where I was having problems like this, and it's one of the first things I'll often recommend, is especially if the cat's peeing on the bed or peeing on furniture, if there's anything you can do where you could go buy like a mattress cover that's got a waterproof underlining to it, so that at least if she's peeing on something, she's not ruining it irreparably, so that it gives you a little bit of time to see if you can work through it without feeling like you're just gonna, you know, go yeah. crazy.
Good luck, Corey. Thank you very much for calling. And Karen in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks. Great advice. I have a question. I've got three dogs that just tested positive for tick-borne illnesses, although mm-hmm. they aren't displaying any symptoms at the moment.
Okay.
Right.
Two with Lyme disease and one with anaplasmosis, I guess. I know they've all had engorged ticks in spite of regular use of Frontline, so I encourage people to check their dogs for ticks and stuff, as well as using that stuff. But what is your recommendation for follow-up? I'm getting additional tests, but if they aren't showing any symptoms, as far as, you know, lethargy, lameness, whatever.
Right.
Do you encourage treatment?
It's a tricky business, and here's what goes on is that when we do these tests, a lot of the time we have to really understand what a positive test mean. And so a positive test for Lyme disease, usually what that means is someone did a test to see if a dog had antibodies to Lyme disease. And that's usually called a positive test. Now, a positive antibodies for Lyme disease only just means that a dog was, at some point in that dog's life, exposed to Lyme disease. It doesn't mean that the dog is currently infected with Lyme disease. Around here, especially up in the river valleys,
yep.
About 90% of the dogs are going to have antibodies to Lyme disease because that's where the exposure happens. And so often dogs with no clinical signs that have antibodies are not considered to be sick, and in many cases may actually have some kind of protection because antibodies give some kind of serologic protection for Lyme disease. And so, you know, that's something to really consider when you're looking at a test is what does the positive test tell you? And in many cases, it doesn't tell you anything at all about disease. It just tells you about exposure to disease.
Okay. Thanks, Karen, for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Newberry, our guest today, she'll be with us right up until 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Newberry of the National Shelter Medicine Extension, or she is a National Shelter Medicine Extension veterinarian. I'm not going to go through that whole title again.
With UC Davis. You can say that.
With UC Davis. All right. And also the medical director of the Dane County Humane Society. So pleased to have her along, and every line is filled. So well, before we go to the phones, though, one thing, and I mentioned lilies.
Yeah.
And let's start. Lilies are highly toxic to cats.
Yeah, so I guess I would include, you know, if you do have cats, I think I would take that off my shopping list.
Yeah.
And, you know, many cats will get away with nibbling a lily leaf or two and be fine. But there are cats who will nibble a lily leaf and go into fulminant, you know, renal failure, kidney failure, and die from it. And so I think the risk is so high that it should be one of those plants that's just up on your list for not having around the house. And, you know, it's funny because normally one of the things that I tell people, and when we look at sort of toxic events, it's usually dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was telling my son this morning, you know, he said, well, why did our dog eat the pack of gum? And I said, well, you know, because dogs are just not quite as discriminating as cats. And so that's really the truth of it. As we were talking about before, you know, dogs like novelty. If they find a pack of gum, wow, that's kind of interesting. I think I'll eat that. And cats don't usually do that. But when it comes to plants, cats really do like plants, and they like to chew on them. And if there isn't, you know, grass and other things that that cats like to chew on around, they're going to pick the thing that potentially could kill them. And so it's up to us to be aware of what those things are and keep it out of the house.
And you can find that on the ASPCA.
Yep, there's
website.
A whole listing. There's, I think they have their 10 most toxic plant list, and lilies are on there.
Okay. Well, let's go to Cindy and Nina now, who's been patiently waiting. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have two English Springer Spaniels. One is 15 years old.
Wow, good for you.
And one is 1 year.
Oh, goodness.
A year ago, we had an episode just before I got the puppy where she had that old dog syndrome.
Of
what, like, is it called aphasia?
Okay, kind of neurologic problems.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And she bounced back from that pretty good. And I wish that you would speak to that that thing for a minute. And then also, I've noticed that my old dog, who is 15, her elbows look really good. And we've had other Springer Spaniels whose elbows, when they get old, are so crusty and, you know, they just look awful.
Is You're talking about the skin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it because of the pressure points?
Yeah.
Okay.
This new puppy of mine, when we were fooling around and, you know, on the floor, and I have felt when he has laid his front legs across my chest, those elbows are so sharp. And when she has done it, you know, you don't even feel her on you.
Yep.
Yeah, so all animals have a, you know, little slightly different conformation, and it may just be a question of, you know, not so much the conformation of the bones as what's covering over the bones. And many dogs do develop calluses and things like that in the areas of their elbows. It depends on, you know, how they lay and what they spend their time laying on and their individual skin and things like that. Puppies do tend to sort of feel pointier, and young dogs, you know, tend to feel pointier. And it, I think it tends to be, you know, because of the way they lie on you, probably more than anything. You know, my son seems pretty pointy sometimes, too, when he's crawling around on me. I think that they just don't have as much consideration for the people that they're crawling across. It tends to make things feel pointier. And, you know, the skin of different dogs develops in different ways. And so that may be why you're seeing it, you know, the differences. Springers usually have enough hair coat covering their elbows that they don't tend to develop really big calluses on their elbows. So that's, you know, another thing to think about.
What about the aphasia?
Yeah, and so, again, I'm not exactly sure what you were seeing, but there are, you know, some older dogs will have something that seems a little bit like a stroke in a human seems, and often they will get through it quite well. It takes some patience and supportive care. And did your dog rebound from it completely?
Yes.
Yeah, and so
she was very crooked
yeah.
for, you know, several months.
Yeah.
You know, she would walk up the driveway and you'd think that she was, you know, going to go off the side of the driveway before she
got there.
Right, and so it does take a lot of patience in owners and a lot of awareness in owners and veterinarians to be able, first of all, to figure out that that's in fact what's going on and not something more serious, because obviously when we see neurologic signs in older dogs, we worry about other things and tumors and things like that. And so it does take some patience, but for dogs that really do have that particular syndrome, they often can come through it really, really quite well.
Thanks very much for calling, Cindy. Appreciate it. And Roger in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Raj.
Hi there. The reason I'm calling is I'm going to be getting a dog soon, and I want to protect it from flea and ticks. And I hadn't been able to find a collar that takes care of both the flea and ticks, and I'm wondering if there's any drawback or disadvantage to getting two separate collars and having that on the dog?
Well, what I would recommend instead of using the collar, you know, since toxicity is kind of the theme of our day, that many of the collars are not the best health-wise for the dog. And they, again, are on the list of things that the dogs can eat and have it make them really sick. So if the dogs either are with other dogs and eat the collars off of those dogs, and even just the toxins that are in the collars, they're not as effective at prevention, and they're also, you know, have some toxicity issues. And so usually what we recommend is to use one of the spot-on products that are mostly available from veterinarians, though I have seen them for some of the different products for sale in some of the pet stores as well.
I see. You're recommending the topical application?
Yeah. The monthly preventative products are the ones that I would really recommend going with.
Okay. Well,
instead of the
much.
Collars, yeah. They're better for the dog's health all around, and better because they're better at prevention, too.
Thanks, Roger, for calling. Appreciate it. Mary and Racine, it's your turn next. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a cat who's about 15 or 16. I'm not really sure exactly how old he is.
Okay. He's up there, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty lively, you know, and seems to be in good health. Recently I'm noticing him drinking quite a bit more water.
Okay.
He is not to the point where I'm seeing him every 5 seconds, you know, going to his water dish.
Uh-huh.
But I notice the water kind of disappearing at a faster rate, you know, than it was before. And in the litter box, I use that clumping, you know, litter, and it's not really clumping that well. His it seems to be kind of sticky.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if he's developing diabetes.
Well, he could be. We call it PUPD, and it really should be maybe the other way around, but it's polyuria and polydipsia are the things that we're talking about. So he's peeing too much and he's drinking too much, and it goes in that order because what happens is that something is going on systemically with the cat that makes them pee more than they should, and so then they have to kind of drink to keep up with that.
Okay.
So that they don't get dehydrated. Many people think it goes the other way around, and it's important not to think that, because some people think, oh, he's just drinking so much, that's why he's peeing so much, I'm going to just not give him as much water. But they need the water to keep up with what they're peeing out. But what he needs is to check with the vet, and it could be diabetes. There's several things in older cats that can cause them to start drinking too much and urinating, diluting their urine too much. Basically, cats are really, really good at concentrating their urine.
Okay.
And as they get older, there's several things that can cause them to not concentrate so well. Diabetes is among them. Hyperthyroidism is among them. And so is kidney disease. And so those are all things that you want to, they're pretty easy things to screen for, but those are all things that we want to get the cat screened for, because many of them are things that you could intervene and treat and or at least do some supportive care to keep him, especially if he's still spunky at 15 or 16. So that's great.
Was that hyperthyroidism?
Yeah,
hyper.
Oh, okay. Cats mostly get hyperthyroid and dogs tend to get hypothyroid.
I have had him on feline KD for quite a while.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, I don't even remember now what my original reason was. I guess, you know, he had had trouble in the past when he was still middle-aged with having those magnesium crystals, you know, in his urine.
So
and
KD,
it might be because of that, but I don't even remember if there was some other, you know, reason for it.
KD is a low-protein diet that's given to cats with renal disease sometimes, and the theory being that if there's a little bit lower protein, it may help the kidney. If you're not excreting quite so much protein, it may help the kidney. And so it may be that your vet already knew that your cat had some, you know, minor kidney problem if the vet recommended the cat going on KD. But those are all things I would check out with the vet to find out if there was some early sign of renal disease, and now the cat's drinking more and peeing more. It may be something that, you know, now is a time to sort of intervene with sub-Q fluids or things like that that'll help your cat, you know, live a little longer and have a little better quality of life.
Okay. I do have another question about him, too. He's very, like I said, you know, he seems to be quite lively. But his back legs don't seem to be working quite as well, you know, as they have in the past in terms of being able to jump up on things.
Those are all things I think that are probably somewhat related to each other. So it's time to get him checked out and see, because any of the things that I'm talking about could be potentially, you know, also affecting other parts of his body and making him a little weaker or things like that. So I would get him into the vet and get some blood work done to check for those. You know, those are the kind of the big three.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful. Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, you're next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Glad I was able to get in before the end of the show. A couple of quick things. First of all, why is it necessary? I have a 14-year-old chow mix, and I put her on heartworm. Pretty coming up probably next month, I'll probably start her. Why is it necessary to get a fecal test before? I just don't quite understand that. And the other thing is my new next-door neighbors just got a puppy, a female. My dog is a female. And while my dog hasn't been aggressive to her, she just she kind of growls at her a little bit or whatever. And they, in fact, just yesterday took that puppy in to get her spayed. And I'm wondering if that has any effect on her behavior. My dog towards that dog, my dog is spayed.
Mm-hmm. certainly dogs, when they're in heat, it changes their behavior. Usually if the puppy hasn't been through a heat, it probably won't change her behavior much and won't change your dog's behavior to her. You know, older dogs growling at puppies is normal behavior. You know, you have to, you know, watch and be careful of the way that the interactions go. But for example, my puppy, who's at the vet school right now, is really rude with older dogs. She just doesn't get it. And as she's getting older, I'm actually starting to think, well, actually, maybe she does get it. And she just thinks that she should always be in charge. And so, you know, when she was younger and she was around older dogs tended to correct her fairly frequently to let her know when she was getting out of line or not. And that's a really normal behavior, you know, for older dogs to correct puppies. But again, it may be that they're not a good match for each other too. And so that's something to keep in mind too.
What about that?
Watch for
the fecal test.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, when it comes to heartworm disease, what we normally do is we do a blood test to test for heartworm disease. And there's actually a couple different ways that we can test for heartworm disease. And the most common one in use now is to do an antigen test to look for an antigen that adult heartworms produce. That antigen test won't be positive until at least 6 months or about 6 months after a dog's actually been infected. And so that's the reason that we always test in the spring, because if a dog was infected in the late fall, it gives about enough time for that test then to be positive when we test. There's another test that can be done where you actually look for microfilaria. So those are very immature larval forms of the worms, and you can actually physically look for those in the blood. Those, again, are produced later on an infection. So those, you know, again, we want to look for those a little bit later. You know, that's why we look for those in the spring. Initially, the heartworm treatments that were available, and there's some that still have this, that are still available, can be really dangerous to give to dogs if they do have circulating microfilaria in their bloodstream. And so we want to rule out that that's there before we start them on heartworm treatment. It's not true for every heartworm treatment, and many of the heartworm treatments that are available now are given to dogs even if we know they're positive. We still give it to them because in some cases, or some cases if we don't know they're positive, in some cases those preventatives can actually treat backwards for us. They're such great drugs. I've not ever heard of a fecal being done in order to rule out heartworm disease. And what my guess is that many veterinarians use that opportunity for kind of the spring checkup for dogs to get them heartworm tested, get a physical exam. Some will even use it, you know, that's the time of year we're going to vaccinate. And let's also check a fecal and make sure that the dog doesn't have worms on top of everything else. So we'll get them, you know, kind of their spring cleaning. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks for calling. Marie in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I was wondering, I just have a puppy, and she's about 4 months, and she's not real thrilled with her food. I mean, she eats, but, you know, not as much as she should. I was wondering if there was a way I could maybe use, like, oatmeal or something that I make to kind of entice her to eat.
Do you think she's underweight?
Oh, she's a skinny little puppy, yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, she's not, the vet doesn't think she's underweight, but I mean, she's, you know, she's got ribs, and I mean, she could eat a little bit better.
So most dog food is formulated to be complete. And right, once we start adding all sorts of different stuff to it, it makes it not balanced anymore. And so what you may want to try to do is see if there's different dog foods that she likes, or, you know, something that she likes more than what she's eating. And there's lots and lots of different dog foods out there. And there's, you know, cheaper versions way on up to probably more than you spend on your own food for balanced diets and different formulations. And so that would be one thing I would want to, you know, think about. The other thing I would definitely want to think about is there are some dogs who are just a little bit pickier. None of them live at my house. But, you know, And so there's always something that you definitely want to rule out. You know, well, is there a problem? Is there something that's causing the pup not to want to eat as much really as she should? And is she really not eating as much as she should, or is she not eating as much as it seems like to you that she should? And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about kind of calorie intake for the size of the puppy that she is. And so you want to kind of make sure you've thought about all those things. And then if you still think she's really not eating quite enough, you may want to try and see if there's other foods that she likes better. I think I would start with that so that you're keeping the diet balanced.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Barb in Crystal Lake, hi to you.
Hi. I've got an 8-year-old cat, and he's diabetic with kidney dysfunction. He's been getting, for 3 months, he's been getting treatment. And the treatment is subcutaneous fluid injections, uh-huh. and he's now up to 11 units of Lantus twice a day, but his glucose is still at 420.
Okay.
And I'm wondering what other experimental or what else can we do?
There is an insulin that is available now that's really designed just for cats, and it's called PZI. And it may be something you want to talk to your vet about,
okay.
and see if the cat can get better regulated on PZI than he can on the other drug. And it's a drug that many, you know, mm-hmm. cat veterinarians will reach for as the insulin of choice. It's a little bit more expensive than the other insulins.
This one is too. The Lantus.
Yep.
It's not like Humulin. It's pretty
right.
sophisticated. But.
So you may want to see if the cat could get better regulated on the PZI.
Okay.
But it may also be that there's some other reason why the cat's, you know, not getting regulated, and so you definitely want to look into that more. But I think I would start out by trying the PZI and see if you can get him regulated.
The one problem we have is the KD food because it's high in carb,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you can't give him the high protein food that he would have needed ordinarily for diabetes.
Right, and so this is one of the things that happens with cats, is that cats, when they get older, and cats when they get some of the metabolic systemic diseases that they get, tend to opt for two at a time or three at a time. And so often what you wind up doing is balancing as best you can the treatment for all of them. A similar example is hyperthyroidism and kidney disease, because hyperthyroidism itself is actually a little bit protective for the kidneys. And so sometimes you'll treat a cat who's hyperthyroid and remove some of that thyroid hormone and realize, oh, wow, the cat's got kidney disease too. And so you have to wind up balancing as best you can those two things. And so it may be that if you can't get the cat regulated and the veterinarian thinks that regulating the diabetes may wind up being more of a priority than the KD food for the kidney. And so what you wind up doing is, you know, trying to strike that balance as best you can. And it's usually not perfect, but you try to, it's often has to be very fluid too. And so now, you know, you may say, wow, we really can't get this cat regulated. We're going to have to try a different food and see if that will help. But it may be that a different insulin will help too.
And regulation, is there a time limit or on regulating, or is it just, I'm just wondering how long it takes to get them regulated?
I would think, you know, usually you can get them regulated within a couple of months.
So a couple of months
sooner,
anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sandy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lots of great questions today. And I hope your little puppy turns out okay.
I hope so, too.
Next time you're on, you're going to have to fill us in
we'll
on
fill
all the
you
details.
In. She's in good hands, I know.
Thank you. Dr. Sandra Newberry of Madison is a National Shelter Medicine Extension Veterinarian with the Corret Shelter Medicine Program at the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And she continues to be the medical director of the Dane County Humane Society. Always fun to have her along, and she'll be back, and we'll talk with her again on the program. Just to let you know, somebody called earlier in the week, I think, or maybe it was last week, and asked about bees, about some issues with honeybee colony problems. Well, tomorrow at 11, Phil Pelletieri of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, UW Extension Entomologist, has an update on the honeybee colony troubles across the country. And then at 11:45, we'll visit with Milwaukee outdoor writer Eric Hansen. He says it's time for some spring outings in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.